Hi, folks. I have a special guest with me. His name is Michael Hewlett. He is a realtor with Jamison Sothersby. He has been a realtor for probably at least the last 20 or 25 years in the Chicagoland market, pretty much raising his two kids as a single dad almost their entire lives almost. And he decided that he was going to write a book. So let's get into it and figure it out. Mike, how are you?
Good, good. That's quite the intro.
That's all you're getting. They ain't gonna get any more than that.
Take that. I mean, it's not 100% accurate, but I'll go with it. But
perfect. So I know you were born in Michigan. So how did you get to Chicago? Let's get there. Let's get down to where you started from.
And we're going way back.
We're going way back.
So I went to Michigan State University.
And I'm sorry for you folks that he did.
Yeah, he's a University of Michigan fan, so this is a problem, but. It's a problem more for me because I lose bets when I talk to him, but about these games. But so I went there, and then at the time, this was mid '90s, when you grew up in Detroit, there was not much to Detroit at the point. So, and I wanted to live in a big city, and in fact, that's why I was drawn to Michigan State. I love the diversity. I went there and visited friends, and it was all these different people, and I loved the student union, and it just had a great vibe to it. And I've always been drawn to diversity and all different types of people from different places, and so. When I was thinking about moving on from Michigan State, where am I going to go? I want to go to a big city. If you're in the Midwest, it's Chicago.
I'd have to agree. But you're missing out one big point, Mike.
Which is?
You are not just alone. Your brothers are going to see this, and they are going to. Yes. I'm just saying.
But they didn't go to college with me. So I was raised a triplet. There's three boys.
There's three of you.
Yeah, three of us, which was always fun. But they did their own thing after school. Like, everybody does their own thing,
And that will be for another podcast at another time when I can get the three of them together to see how it is to be with triplets. That'll be fun.
That's how I ended up here. I just wanted a big, cool city.
So how did you get into real estate, or what was your major when you were at Michigan State?
It's a mouthful. I was a screw off in high school, and then I had to go to community college for 2 years to get my grades figured out. And I learned to study there, and I learned to do well. But I still didn't do well enough. I don't even remember what I had. I think I had a 3.4 or 3.5, but it still wasn't enough to get into the business school at Michigan State at the time, especially as a transfer student. This was in the early 90s. So I got into a major that a friend of mine was in. It's called Commercial Recreation and Tourism Management. So it was like management of like theme parks, resorts, marinas. It's basically all business degree, but it wasn't in the business school. So that's what I went to school for.
And then how did you get to Chicago and also decide, all right, I'm doing real estate?
So real estate was a path that took a few years. I got here and I got a job from a friend that worked at a company. It was in logistics. It was 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. holding two phones. It was like on Boiler Room, that movie, if you ever.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, but it was like that, negotiating freight rates all day, and that's what it was. And I realized there very quickly that I never wanted to sit at a desk all day. That was not me. And so I looked around for different things, and real estate was great because you can work as much as you want or as little as you want. It gives you diversity in what you're doing throughout the day. And so it worked great. So here I am, 20, I don't know, so many years later, I got licensed. This is my 25th year licensed. So full-time, probably 24 years, I don't know.
But when you started out in real estate, did you work for a brokership, or did you start on your own,
or did you have your own business? At the time, they were the largest builder in the city called American Invesco.
Okay.
And then the Galitas family owned him. Nick Sr. was the old guy, and he was a great old guy. He was really good to learn from. They had excellent training there. But I knew I didn't want to stay with just one development, one product line. I wanted to branch out into... I was particularly interested in new construction. That's why it was a lot of my career was. But I wanted to do different things. So then I went and moved on to brokerage community from there.
Very cool. And then you did open your own brokerage at some point.
I did. Yeah. So that's an interesting story, but I'll keep it brief.
Let's go. Get into it. So, where did it go?
It's like anything. You're young and you get into business. And I think I was late 20s at that point. And you think that everyone... is your friend, and you think that everyone, maybe not your friend, but you don't think that people have the motivations that they do.
Ulterior motives.
Yeah, it's the drive for excess, the drive for money is what I would call it. And so I mean, ultimately, you know, I had a girl that I had trained with, Lisa, and we were great friends. We're still great friends today. We ended up being business partners in that business, but we had a managing broker that kind of, you know, who owned the firm. I won't name any names at the time.
Please don't.
Did, yeah, yeah. Actually, she's still around, but the firm's not.
Okay.
But she had done something that what I would consider very unethical. And so as soon as this transaction closed, we were out of there. And of course, she was extremely pissed. Like, she was mad. But she didn't get it. And I just had to sit her down. Like, both of us sat her down and explained, like, this is what you did. Like, you're supposed to be watching out for us. You know, we're a couple of years in the business. And so my friend and kind of we were sharing things together, like deals together and stuff at the time. Lisa, we're just like, why don't we do this on our own? Like, we've been doing, I think it was our third year. And anyways.
Was this so, pre-subprime or was this during the
this was
subprime?
2000, oh my gosh.
Because the subprime started in 2000, 2001 until the
crash. Well, I didn't go into brokerage until 2001. So I was in the business 3 years when I started my own company. So it seemed early to have that little experience, but I was in it 100%.
Yeah.
I knew everything about everything because I was completely absorbed in it. So I felt very confident at the time going into it, even though I knew I was young. But and so we did that for 4 years. We did really well. We had some builders. We did a lot of new construction. Like 70% of the business was new construction. And then I felt the market change. I remember it was the fall of 2007, and a builder called me. He said, "What's going on with their open house activity?" And I was like, "I have no idea. Like, but it's down. It's definitely down. Like, because you know we would send tracking reports to him on Monday." And I just started thinking, like, you could feel the change, you know, and I had never experienced that. I didn't know. I mean, I was like, I'd worked in corporate world. And then before that, I worked in breweries and, like, you know, helped brew beer and do the marketing for beer and stuff. Right. So I wasn't, these were small breweries. I had never worked, you know, I'd never seen a sea change in an industry in my life at that point. And it's quite a thing when you're a kid, you know, I mean, well, I call myself a kid, even though I was 30 or something, but I felt like a kid at the time because I felt just totally helpless. Like, what is going on? So I knew the market was changing, so that spring, my business partner, Lisa, and I decided to part ways. I decided to close down the company and then merge into Jamison at that point. So we moved the whole team, the company, into a team at Jamison, and that was probably March or April of whatever that year was, 2008, because the market crashed that October.
So how did the subprime affect you? Because I know, because I do mortgages, so
yeah,
that 2004 is when I got into it, and then... Man, I saw a lot of shady stuff going on.
I never saw much shady stuff, to be honest, but I was doing a lot more new construction. I wasn't doing subprime. I was doing new construction on the north side of the city, you know, some little bit on the south side of the city near Lott and the kind of near south side that was emerging Bridgeport at the time. We sold a ton of townhomes and single families back then and all over the north side. So I didn't really deal with that as much, but it was a massive shockwave when it hit. Like, I remember the first... Like 2009, I don't even know how many paychecks I got. Oh, almost, I could probably count on one hand how many paychecks.
Well, we'll get there. And the only reason why I was asking is how subprime affected you. Because, man, I know for me, I had one of my best friends building a house at that time.
Yeah.
And I was doing his mortgage, and he was doing a first and second. And our second mortgage was, I won't name the name, but they're a bigger bank now. But they pulled the rug out. Like, on a mid-afternoon, we were closing. We were supposed to close, like, within 7 days of the final contract offer. We were going to the table and they just said, "We're done. All second mortgages, no more."
Oh yeah.
And they were the largest second mortgage company that you could get a second mortgage from anywhere. And they completely just shut it down. I got on the phone, I was like yelling at everybody, like, "You gotta get this done." Because he's building a house at this moment.
It needs to get done.
Oh yeah. And they basically called back and it was like, on a whim like that, they're like, "Okay, it's 9.5%, take it or leave it." What choice
What are you gonna do?
I called him up.
I've never seen anything, even to this day, I've never seen anything like what happened.
It was horrid.
At that, like, 2 or 3 month period.
It was absolutely horrible. And I had to call my best friend and tell him, "Dude, we're at 9.5%. You got to take it because otherwise you got to come up with cash.
Or else you're going to be lose it all."
And so he did. But for me, I felt terrible. That's why I was wondering how it affected you. Because at that point, that's when I got out. I left the mortgage business and I went out because at that point.
Maybe you were smarter than me.
And that is where I want to go. We're going to get there as to, like, what did you end up doing? Because I know I had to make a paycheck. I mean, I was raising a family myself, and it was just like one of those things that I needed a paycheck coming in. And unless you were working for a bank, and every lender throughout, I mean, all the subprime loans, gone. Every subprime lender, gone. Yeah. Washington Mutual, gone.
Gone, yeah.
And unless you were working for a Chase or a Bank of America or something like that, where they were paying you some stipend to work there, so many mortgage people, brokers, like, or consultants like me, left the business because there was nothing.
No business to do.
I mean, every bank went to 700 or 720 credit score. You had to have X amount of dollars. You had to put 10% down. You know, the game just completely changed, at least for 3 years. How did you make it through that?
A couple years.
How did you make it through that, raising two babies basically on your own?
Well, as I wasn't on my own at the time. I mean, I was only on my own for a part of the time, raising the kids. I had, you know, their mother, that was compounded because she had had, you know, well, as you know, that some serious problems at that point.
We've talked about it, yeah.
Yeah, so that all happened when the market crashed. Great timing. So,
as everything
I don't know. You know, I remember thinking back, though, like, at the time, I remember thinking, like, I'm not doing anything else. I had put so much energy into learning that business and learning every single aspect about it. I was on the professional standards committee. You know, I did so many things through the Association of Realtors. Like, I was 100% absorbed in the industry. There was no way I was leaving. It wasn't even an option. If I had to fight it out, whatever, but 2009 was rough. That was a brutal, brutal year. I made more in my first year of real estate, not knowing anything, than I did in 2009.
That's probably everybody.
There was no business to be had.
Realtors left the business because of that, because it was just debt. I mean, it was either short sales, foreclosures, and unless you knew how to do a lot of that stuff, you weren't necessarily selling homes that people were putting up for sale because they were gone. I mean, everybody lost their value.
It was tough. And I had, whatever. That's what it is. But I do remember that in March of 2010, all of a sudden the phone started ringing. Because a lot of what happened with those banks, and if you remember, a lot of that cycled through during 2009. So the crash was 2008, right? October 2008. I totally remember it. And it was 6 to 8 to 9 months before people realized, okay, we have to start doing something with these properties. And as you know, banks move at the rate of molasses. I mean, they're just
They were nitpicking everything.
Well, I had buyers who probably said, I'll buy that, I'll buy this. Okay, let me try to reach the bank. No one to talk to. No one knows what's going on. No one knows where the balance sheets are at. We don't know what we can give this asset up for because we don't know what the total assets are. So it was a mess. But by early 2010, I think a lot of that had settled down and they started releasing more and more assets at that point. And people saw deals. And so that's when things started to turn around. And but 2009... No thanks, man.
I don't know how you made it through there because I left and just going in like almost 2007, 2008, and I didn't jump back in until 2011 is when I got my feet back wet.
Yeah.
Because that's when things seemed that the banks were starting to lower the credit scores back down to the 620-ish, 640-ish.
Yeah, so you could start to do more deals
because otherwise, nobody could buy a house unless you were A paper, what we considered A paper, 720, 700.
Yeah.
And 10% down. And who has 10%? Very, very few.
I mean, you're
at that higher level of making $100,000 to $150,000 a year. But you know what happened was when during the subprime stuff is like where everybody, a waiter could come in or a busboy, and these, I hate to say it, but these idiots who didn't give a crap about.
Oh, I remember how bad the loans were. You could literally just put a promissory note and I'm good.
They didn't give a shit, and it was just like it was like churn and burn. That's where, like, for me, and I'm very ethical. That's just how I am. I've never done those type of loans because I just wouldn't do it because I could not.
Yeah.
Like, I already knew in 2 years, these guys cannot afford this house. A $400,000 house as a busboy. How in the hell is he going to be able to afford that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Got their family, their two kids, and everything else, and it's like. They're foreclosing. They're going bankrupt.
People want the American dream, and that's what it was about. It was like people wanting to reach for that, and you know, God bless people for wanting it, but it was not the right choice because those loans, you know, a lot of those loans back then were. I remember people used to do ARMs all the time, different things, short term, and then when the rates started going up, and you know, I mean, you'd adjustable rate mortgage for people that don't know ARMs. So they're usually 3 years, 5 years back then.
3 year fire away. Yeah, now they got them up to 10.
Yeah,
which is
but
great.
Back then it seemed like the 3 year and the 5 year were the most popular because they were like a full point below the interest rate, whatever everything else.
Yeah,
so those loans were really problematic, and but we live and we learn, you know, it is what it is now. Now we look back and we think we'll never do that again. Of course, we probably will at some point, something will happen.
I hope
but
not, because that was... That
it'll,
was
just have, it'll just be a different form.
True.
But, you know...
True.
I mean, we're going through it right now a little bit the last few years since the rates started jumping up in 2022, and so...
You know what, and then not, since we're talking about it, I mean, we're going into it, like here in the Chicago market, I mean, the prices have gone up. I mean, I listen to Crane's... I forgot his name.
Dennis
Rodkin.
Yeah,
he's always on WGN, and he's talking about how the prices have jumped. I think 5 to 7% just in the Chicago market alone.
Yeah,
we're like the third highest, I think, as far as everything still going up in price than anywhere else in the country. And I'm just like, so a $200,000 house now is already $350,000, $375,000. How does a first time home buyer really jump into something like that? And
no,
then, and for me, what I see with talking to other realtors that I deal with, it's like, if you get into that, if you find a house, it's $250,000, $275,000. It is a hole in the wall. It needs a ton of work. And if for some reason it doesn't, you got 20 offers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then for my business, it's like fathom right now because everyone's dying because the rates aren't great.
Yeah.
So it's like you got 15 different lenders all fighting for one house. And it's like, who's going to get it? Because we all need to eat. I mean, luckily for me, it's just been whatever.
Agent same, buyer same. It's the same thing for everybody, but
yeah,
it's just a sign of the times. It is what it is. It's like, you know, historically, you know, if you look at the rates, when I got in the business, the rates are higher than what they are now in early, 2000. And I think right now, today, when we're filming this, they're in the upper sixes probably right now.
Yeah, 6.7. 6.5,
okay. They, you know, they change every day, but historically, not a bad rate at all. But so many sellers or homeowners are locked in around 3%, give or take. Some people as low as 2.5.
I had one 1.95.
I've never even heard of below 2. That's insane.
Yeah.
That's like an auto loan from that same time when you were good. I think I had a loan on my car for 1.95. But
Yeah,
so everybody, it's not where the rate is, because historically it's not a bad rate. It's that gap. And if you know, in real estate, most sellers move, they sell and they move up 1.5 times. You probably know this. So if you sell a $300,000 home, you're going to move up to a $450,000 home. That's roughly the math. So now if you take that increased mortgage amount, now, of course, their value's higher and they've paid down their mortgage hopefully over time, but the rate difference that jumps that payment, especially in that higher amount, is a massive swing when you go from a 2.75 to a 6.75. It's
huge.
A huge swing
it's
in rate.
Huge.
And no one can swallow it. And that's why we have, that's why prices are going up, because that's contracting the inventory that's on the market, which is driving prices up. And there's no quick fix to it. There's not going to be. If we had a huge drop in rates, which there's no indication of that, it could happen. But who knows?
And we're not going to get into property taxes, because I am like, with the property taxes and Brandon Johnson in the city of Chicago, just ridiculous.
You just be grateful if you don't own any commercial property in Cook County, because those are the properties that have really been hammered. They've really increased their assessor fees. Just crazy. But residential is always about the same. Whatever you buy, I always tell people, just figure that in the next couple years, it's going to go to about 2% of your purchase price, right? So if you buy a $500,000 property, you're going to have a $10,000 tax bill in a few years. That's what it's going to go to. Hopefully not more. You know, if it's less,
we'll
great.
We'll see.
It is what it is. That's just the way it is. So.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting that I didn't realize you had been with Jamison Sotheby for so long.
Yeah, since 2008.
Because I haven't stayed with a mortgage company, because we're always trying to find the better interest rate, to the better underwriting system,
the quicker
that you can get the loan done, the more business you get in, but then it's always the rate. So why did you end up staying with Jamison Sotheby? And I'm not doing a plug, commercial plug for them. I'm just saying, because don't find it, because I know in your business too, a lot of times realtors are jumping to different companies, because especially if you're a producer like you are, somebody wants to buy you and somebody wants to bring you back and take you and they give you all offers. So why did you stay where you're at? Just curious. Just, we've never talked about it.
Well, I jumped around a few times before that, when I was the first two or three years of my career. And I had realized very quickly, it's all the same shit, if I can swear.
Gives a shit.
it's the same everywhere. You have your own business. It doesn't matter where you hang your license, but
Well, there's fees and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I know I'm not going to name names, but I know there's others that charge more fees because their names are more popular, blah, blah, blah.
So that's why I stay at Jameson Sotheby's, because they're, first of all, I've come to know all the management, the owners, they're all great. They support me 100%. Like, you pay a split, and a lot of agents have an issue, like, oh, you got to pay such and such a percentage to every deal. That's not fair. I do all the work. Well, that's not true at all. That's the wrong way to look at the business. They do so much for you, and then to have that support, and then have the marketing support, and then, you know, be able to pick up the phone and call the owner and text them, like, immediately. That stuff's great, man.
Yeah.
And I don't want to jump around them. I've done jumping around. I did that when I was early in my career. Like, I know that wherever I go, it's like, it's up to me. Like, it's that simple. It's the same thing with every agent.
Every self-employment.
You can jump around, but it's like, what's the old saying? You know, don't confuse motion with progress. Yeah. That's how I look at it. Like, if I can't make it work here, I'm not going to make it work anywhere. So I'm not going anywhere.
Right.
So that's how I see it. But
so, I don't know. All right. So you're still doing real estate. But at the same time, during all that, you're raising, because you got divorced, and you're raising two kids on your own. And how did you figure that out as a single dad? I mean, I know there's great the single moms, but it's not very often that you have single dads raising children on their own.
No, it seemed like I was the only one at the time back in, you know. So it was perfect timing because my wife at the time had some, you know, pretty serious issues with different things. And so that happened when the market crashed. So I had a double whammy. And then I had the kids on my own for a while. And then, as you know, I married Jen, who I'm currently married to, even though that's, you know, interesting times there. But there was a while there where I was on my own entirely with the kids. And that was just interesting times because dads don't usually do that.
And you're raising a boy and a girl, so it's not like you're raising two boys.
It was hard. It was hard, but it wasn't like a big deal. I didn't make a big deal of it. So you just do what you got to do.
But that's your attitude. That's always been your attitude.
Well, yeah, but that attitude helps. What other attitude are you going to have?
You can have a lot of different attitudes.
Well, you could, but
you know, poor is me, play the victim, why me? And trust everybody, a lot of people do that. We do it. I do it. I've done it.
So well, I do it too at times too, but you know, I always tried to help their mom because she had some serious issues with things and, you know, mental things and alcohol issues and stuff, even though, of course, we're having a cocktail.
There's no
but, wrong with that. But, you know, and I tried to help her continue. To this day, I try to help her a little bit, even though she doesn't talk to me much. But, you know, I wanted the kids to have their mom, and it is what it is. You can only, you know, in my brain, I would always think, I can't make that horse drink. I cannot make that horse drink.
Yeah.
Give her water. I can give her everything. And, you know, I actually sent her a copy of that book. This book.
We'll get into
just
it.
Recently, a few weeks ago, and so, but I don't know. So,
I mean, there's
hope she's well.
But it's just so many things that, like, going from where you started, coming from Michigan, and no family when you got here.
No, that's what happens when you leave home.
Well, you know, but at the same time, for me, I can't leave Chicago. I'm like, I am like stuck here.
Yeah, your family's.
I've got all my family here, but at the same time, I personally. We already discussed this. Like, I've only gone on my second vacation by myself just recently.
Yeah.
Life.
You gotta do more of that. So I think that stuff is it makes you grow. It makes you grow and reflect, and I think that's good.
I mean, it was different, especially this last trip that I just took before I decided to start a podcast. It was like one of those for me, and we talked about this, where it's like I just did it on a whim, which I never would have done in my entire life. Never would have just said, you know what, screw this. I need to get the hell out of here. Just my head and everything else with my last year for me personally has been kind of like a shit show in a way. But yet growth, learning about myself and everything else that I've gone through in my life. And we've talked about it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like one of those things that going to Mexico by myself and just like reflecting. I'm not trying to get all the metal dramatic, but it's just like reflecting back on what do I want? Like, where am I supposed to go? And God, and you know, I am faithful and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I still don't know. I don't know the right path. I don't know the path of what he's taking me, but it's like, and I didn't have to raise my two girls. I've got two girls. She was with, you know, the girls stayed with their mom and did a great job and stuff. But it was just like, now they're grown and I'm still trying to figure out like, where's my path? You know, I went from what I did previously in my jobs that I had to now, and then mortgages. I think the last 2 years, because of the way the mortgage business had gone, and even prior to that, there's no loyalty to the game anymore, at least for me, at least the way I see it.
I feel like it's always been that way, but yeah.
I've always had where I could always count on certain realtors no matter what, you know, and then sometimes
you have that relationship.
I've always tried to build that relationship and stay friends with them. I've got probably one or two that I am really tight with, you know, and one of them is going to come onto the podcast next week.
Yeah.
But other than that, all the other people that I thought I had relationships with, if something didn't go the right way, it's my fault. Or whatever the case, it could be completely on the seller or the buyer, whatever the case is. And if the deal happens to fall apart, you could have done 40 things great. That one thing, you're done, and they move on to the next.
Well, it's totally true with agents too. It's no different than agents.
Yeah. And with the life, and now, you know, with the world of internet and all these little pop-up mortgage companies, oh, we're going to give you 2 point blah, blah, blah. Well, back then it was 2, whatever. I don't even know what they're doing now, but it's always the race of the chase of the rate. And that's, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's always been the case. People shop it, and that's the way it is.
And when you get coached, don't talk rate, talk to, you know, what the payment is, and we can always refinance and all. That's great. But you know what?
No, they're shopping the rate.
They can have call you at Saturday, 10 o'clock at night. You answer the phone, whatever the case is. But then Joe Schmo on the internet said, I can get an eighth better. So 4.99 sounds better than the 5.125 you're giving me.
Yeah.
Really? Go call Joe Schmo at 4.99 and see if he's going to answer your call on a Saturday or a Sunday.
Well, and what are the
get a hold of him again?
What's the catch? They're soft and a catch. And then the internet companies are terrible with condos, HOAs. That's the worst. But
you know, so we'd digress on that. So for me, the last 2 years, and I think that's where I'm just kind of like, I'm not saying I want to get out of the game. I'll always do it because I do love it. I'm just not in love with it anymore. I'm tired of the...
It's a hard biz, man.
Up and down, commission, chasing the dollar, chasing that money. So hence why I'm like doing something that I actually want to do.
Yeah.
And I think this is fun. I mean, I'm going to be able to talk to people that I want to talk to and find interesting things about them.
But we're having cocktails here.
How can you complain? Yeah, I know.
Really. I mean, I don't know if we can smoke cigars in here, but maybe eventually. I know. I totally get it, man. It's a hard industry, we have a managing broker at Jamison that's just awesome, man, Jim Miller. And he's actually just now the president. But he often says, like, this business is not for everybody. You have to have tough skin. You have to go with the ebbs and flows. Because you're going to have great months. You're going to have great years. You're going to have bad years. You're going to have bad months and many in a row. And you just got to roll with it. It's not for everybody.
Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, I've been doing it for 20 years. So, I mean, and even though I jumped out for 3, but... call it same just 20 thing, years or whatever.
But it takes, you have to be resilient to be in this type of industry. Any business, I look at it, I think I'm a dry cleaner. I look at it as no different than the dry cleaner that I go to. She's got her own business. Things go up, things go down. During COVID, she had a really, really hard time. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter. It's a small business. That's what it is. Like, it's all the same. You know, you're relying on a certain customer base and sometimes the economy doesn't cooperate or, you know, things happen with taxes or government or whatever, and it changes you. And then you have to move and you have to adjust. But for me, I'm not sitting at a desk 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. like I used to. I'll never do that again. Soul-crushing work is what I call it. So I'd rather take my chances out in the wild, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just how I've always been. And I know a lot of people that are that way. And, you know, you're that way, so.
See, and I can't complain too much. I mean, I'm complaining only because I guess, like, again, going back, the last 2 years have been, like, really bad just because the rates have gone up.
It's been brutal. These are the hardest 2 years in the industry except for, like,
back in
obviously
the crash.
2009.
Yeah, when the market crashed.
Yeah, I mean, these are definitely the hardest 2 years because there's been so much transition and the rates have just, the disparity in rates, like it just has locked the market down. So it's starting to slowly ease up this spring, you know, the industry is going to slowly come back, but yeah, we'll see.
There's no way I can go back to sit behind a desk. I mean, I golf come summertime.
Yeah, yeah. It is what it is, man. You don't want that.
2 or 3 times during the week.
Nobody wants to sit behind a desk.
No, I just
even
can't do it because
that
I
like their job,
I like that,
no one wants to sit behind
it's
a fucking desk.
It's the freedom of Cubs game. All right, we're taking off. We're going.
Right.
Hey, do I need to do this? Do I need to do that? I'm good. I can do everything from my phone.
Yeah.
I'm out.
I get it.
So that's the perks. It is the perks, but it's the chase of, you know, just the clients and the ups and downs of all that stuff. I'm a little burned out about it.
Yes, but you also look at, like, if you know people that have achieved anything, whatever achievement means, but if anything, people are like, I would never want my kids to be in this industry. Everyone says that about every freaking industry.
Yeah.
Like, that's what they say. Because if you really want to, like, make a little bit of money and achieve things, It's fucking hard, man.
Yeah.
It's fucking hard. Like, otherwise, you can go sit on the couch or, you know, do whatever you want to do or, you know.
Yeah.
And have the safe job. Like, the best job, the most enjoyable job in my life, when I look back, was when I was at Michigan State. And I worked for this great, like, bar restaurant place. And I would go to work. I would have zero worries before that, except exams and, you know, getting stuff in. And I'd leave work and have zero worries after that. But once you decide to become a business owner, all that goes out the window. 24/7, shit goes through your head. And that's just the way it is. There's no stopping it. Everyone I know that has a business of their own, there's no stopping it. But it's still better than sitting behind a desk all day or having the man tell you what to do all day. It's just, some people are just built for it. That's just what they want, even though it's a little bit maddening.
Yeah.
But there's a lot to learn from it too, a lot of lessons, so.
One of the worst things I found out about myself in this whole journey that I've been doing is I'm an overthinker.
Yeah, you are an overthinker. I concur.
Yeah, thanks. I know. And it's just like one of those things that I'm trying to, because I've always tried to control everything. And I've always tried to.
There's so much irony in that fucking sense.
And it is. I've always tried to control, like, whatever's happening in my life. It's at some way, somehow, some point, I've been trying to control it so that I have the outcome that I want, but that's just not life.
It's not even close.
And I've learned that the hard way, because I've always been trying to manipulate to get things the way that I want. Like, just recently I was thinking about trying to buy the bar restaurant, which, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And every time I pushed to try to get that done, it didn't work my way, because I was trying to control something that I had no control over.
Absolutely.
And it took a little bit, and this is going back to last year, even till now. But even now, I'm going to Mexico actually helped a lot too. And I was already there. I was already getting there in my mindset of, you know what? And whether you're religious or not, I'm just giving it over to God and be kind of, I'm trying to just at the same time of just being like, you know what? If it's supposed to be, it'll be.
Mm-hmm.
I am not going to try to push it. I'm not going to blow up my realtor's phone and be like, hey, how come I didn't get this? How come I didn't get that? What's going on? If you call, you call, you've got news. If you don't, then I'm assuming that it fell through and let's move on. I'm not, because otherwise I was losing sleep.
You can't force things.
And I was trying to force things because I was like getting on the phone. Where's this? Where's that? How come did you call? Did you do this? Did you do that? Why aren't they sending the documents over and all this other stuff? And even prior to this, but I've like just decided to, and we've had these conversations.
We've talked about it, but
mellowed out. Hopefully I've mellowed out to where I'm not trying to control anything. Just let it go. And if it's supposed to be, it'll be.
Yeah.
If it comes to you, then that's what was meant to be. And I got
to
believe that
it's easier
God
to say that up here, but
head.
Then to cash that check down here in your body and your gut is not easy. Like, it's
working out, going to the gym for me has been my saving grace.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously golf is out for right now, but my happy places is now golf or the gym. But that actually helps me because it keeps me from that anxiety building up inside of me of like, what am I doing? What am I going to do? Especially since business is slow with the mortgages. Like, what am I doing? Like, I'm just sitting at home. What am I doing?
Yeah.
You know, but here, at least I'm going to the gym for 2 hours, driving there, driving back, going groceries. And then I get back and I'm like, okay, I need to figure out where am I going with this now? What am I doing?
It's difficult for you too, because you're in a home-based business. Most people don't go to the office if they're doing mortgages or real estate. They work from home.
Yeah.
You go to the office at 10, but we don't really have desks as much like we did 10 years ago. That's all gone. Like,
right.
So yeah, it's kind of lonely when you're at home. I got nothing going on.
It is. It really is. You know,
there's always stuff to do, but like it just depends. It's just
sometimes it's just like idle
hands. The cycles and the season. Yeah,
yeah.
And it's like all that, but I don't know. But you know.
So all right, so we're in the real estate business, and now you decide that you're going to write a book. Where did that pop off at?
Well, I didn't just decide out of the blue. I mean, I don't know, man. I mean, it didn't. I started writing when I was in my 20s, and I didn't really. Where do I begin this? I don't even know. Okay, so I had a professor in college that I had written some pieces for. Because we didn't do a lot of writing in college. We did a fair bit of small writing, but I had a professor in college that had told me that I was a good writer, then I should maybe think about doing something with writing. And I didn't really pay much attention to it at the time. I was like, yeah, whatever, that's not my thing, you know. But I was brewing fucking beer at the time. So I was like,
you make it sound like that was a bad thing.
I'm like, I'm not writing, whatever.
I mean,
but I did have an interest in it. So And then I always knew that I would write someday. I always just knew it. Like, I was just fucking knew it. Like, I just knew it.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, and then, I don't know, I started writing in my 20s, and so I just had things here and there. And then when I had the kids, I just would write things from time to time. And that's kind of how the book evolved. And I, like, that's what I said in the very beginning of it. I wrote, like, the book came to me. I didn't go looking to write a book. It came to me. And, you know, that's why that introduction's called Catching Butterflies. Like, if anybody's in, like, if you're in the creative field, you read that introduction, that's what it feels like. I've talked to so many people, like, from photographers to other writers and different people, and, like, I call it catching butterflies. So when you have that time, that, for me, it's a quiet time early in the morning, and it feels like, it just feels like this connection with something so much larger than who you are in your everyday, and you tap into that thing. Oh, there's this great book by Elizabeth Gilbert, I think. Oh, Big Magic. She wrote Eat, Pray, Love. And she wrote a book after that, many years later, called Big Magic. And she talks about tapping into this thing. And for me, I just call it catching butterflies. They're like fleeting, beautiful thoughts and things that are constantly moving around you, and just try to catch them. And that's what I started doing. So I just started writing them down. And that's how this thing came to be.
So how long did it take you to actually write the book from, like, when you decided that you were going to start doing it?
The earliest stuff I wrote in there was in my 20s, and I'm 52, so. But most of it I wrote after I started writing a lot more when I got divorced to my kid's mom. That was the time of my life that cracked me wide open. And then, you know, you just get stronger after that. That's what you do. So I started writing, I don't know. And then, you know, I don't know. The last 10 years, I've just pieced it together. Trying to, you know, work and do different things. It's a slow process for me. I don't know what else to say.
No, I mean, it is what it is. I mean,
but I probably wrote most of it in 7 years, and or less, 6 or 7 years. But anyways, yeah.
But literally, almost the last year is when you finally decided to put it together and actually put it out.
Yeah, I decided to put it together, and then that's a whole other thing, and you don't realize how much work goes into a single book. You can't even imagine how many hours. It's just ridiculous. Because you have to edit, then you have to edit, then you have to, like, make it make sense. And it's still a bit fragmented. It is what it is. It's more like almost like a life advice book. It's just the way that I think.
That's the way I read it.
Yeah. But
you know, it's so funny, because I hear you, only because I know you. Yeah. I hear you in the words, because your voice is like in my head, and there have been many cigar nights and
I know. I wrote most of it with my kids in my head. I wrote most of it with Ronan and Remy in my head. Like, this is advice to them. Like, if something happens to me, you got this book. Not that it's going to be any good, but whatever.
Stop. No, I thought it was great, you know? I mean, because there's bits and pieces that everybody could easily, the way I took it, everybody can.
Did you actually read it?
I did. Yeah, no, I did. To be honest with you, I didn't realize.
No one reads books, so I don't know.
I'm not a reader. So for me, I
see what I mean? No one reads.
Because I've never been a reader, because my dumb ass, I have to read something sometimes twice or three times in order for me to understand it. I can't just read it once for the most part. I've always been that guy, like, if the teacher's writing everything up on the chalkboard, I'll memorize it, and I'll remember everything that she said. But if you make me read it, I got to read it two or three times.
Yeah, you got to read it.
That's always just been the way. If somebody talks about something, I'll memorize it, and I'll remember it. But
wish I could do
but
that.
Having to be able to read it, it's two or three times, and then I got to, like, go back and, like, did I really understand what that was, what they said? But, like, now,
I do that all the time with books. I do it with podcasts. I'm listening to things when I'm driving all the time. I do that all the time.
Guarantee you, if this is an audiobook, I'll remember it like that. Everything that you said.
I didn't do the audiobook on it yet, but I want to do the audiobook on it. But it's a series of short little excerpts, so it doesn't really flow like a traditional, like, novel would, or, you know, like
no, it's got, it seems like non-fiction. It's just excerpts of your life, almost, like your experiences.
Yeah.
And how
it's just, like,
down through everything, going
observations and I mean, life lessons is probably the best word, but I don't know.
Your life lessons of your experience. I mean, so it is what it is.
Which is universal. It's all the same shit.
Yeah, like, but there's some people, you know, who maybe don't, or some people who are going through it and don't even know that they're going through it. Like, I didn't. I mean, all the conversations that you and I had, it was like, fuck, Mike's right. Like, why am I thinking this way? Why am I always negative? Why am I... Even my ex, you know, would always tell me, she's like, sometimes you just got, like, a dark energy about you. And a lot of it was because of my past experiences of either when I was a kid, going through the police department and everything else, that I had like all these boxes that I would compartmentalize, because that's what we're taught, compartmentalize. Yeah. Don't be emotional as men. You can't show your emotions. I know we talked about it. That's how I was always brought up, as far as don't show, ever show your emotions.
And well, that's society. That's not just how your family.
Having been a cop and being in the military, you don't show emotion. You can't sit there and cry in front of a, you know, somebody who just had somebody die or suicide or whatever the case. You don't just sit there and cry. All that stuff's
got
to be,
which I personally think sucks, because if you've got family members and stuff there, you want to empathize with these people and you want to try to help them through it. Like, but when you're, you know, I don't know.
But what's the empathy? By crying with them? Or being the strong one and not showing that you have.
There's a time to cry, probably, and there's probably a time to not. But you have to balance that out. And you know.
But that's one thing I was never able to do. I always tried to. I had to always feel. What I was taught was, don't ever bring your work home.
Yeah.
So being a cop, it was always like, whatever shit that you're going through at home, at the work, when you get home, you leave everything outside and walk in the door, everything's hunky-dory. That just leave it alone. And I think that's a big issue.
That creates a fracture. That's tough.
And that's, you know, eventually I want to be able to talk to somebody about that therapy and why is that. And there's been a lot of podcasts, I'm sure, about the same thing.
Every first responder goes through that.
You know, the suicide rate, why men's suicide rate so high and everything else. But with your book, I actually did feel like there's excerpts that people can actually read and be like, man, that's actually a good idea, like whatever, like going through your experiences of what you're doing and what you put in the book. Like, I didn't know you believed in reincarnation.
Well,
I don't know if I do.
I mean, everybody's got their own opinion, but it's not even a question. It's central to who we are. It's not even like, that's just me. That's just the research I've done. That's a different rabbit hole.
No, but it's a rabbit hole that we can talk about. My fear, my biggest fear is dying. It's always been.
That's so ironic.
Since I was a kid. And the jobs that I've had, I could have died.
So many people, that's their biggest fear.
Like that.
And you could have, yeah.
But I've had it going through Catholic school my entire life. I mean, I even went and talked to a priest. I remember I was like, 10 maybe or 11. And I was like having anxiety of like, I would wake up thinking that I'm going to die and what's going to happen to me and I'm not going to be here any longer and I'm just done. Like, where am I? What do I do? And I actually had to talk to a priest and he was just like, believe in heaven and believe in God and, you know, all that stuff. So it kind of settled me down. And then it's just so funny because then I went in the military and thank God I didn't have to go to war at the time when I joined.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I became a police officer, which I could have died tomorrow. Anytime I went to work, I could have died. And in my head at that point when I was doing that, and I had a family, it never crossed my mind, like that fear like left. It was like, hey, if I do it, it's because I'm protecting someone or whatever the situation is.
Well, no one thinks it's going to happen to them. But
the idea of death at that point never really crossed my mind that entire time when I was a police officer. But then it started creeping back in again when that was all done. And then my fear of dying again escalated back
to... So you totally blocked it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had to. How am I going to be a police officer if I'm dying?
You got to deal with it. But yeah, I mean, first responders on every level, it's tough, man. It's just tough. It is what it is. Like, you know, whether you're in the hospital as a nurse or a doctor and you're in the ER or... It doesn't matter. There's many levels of first responders. That's tough work.
Where did you get the whole reincarnation part that you actually believe in the reincarnation? Because I'm not saying I don't believe in it.
Well,
I just don't know enough about it. I mean, I don't read the Bible. I believe in God. I believe in my faith and my heart. But I don't go to church every day or every Sunday or whatever just because I have my own issues with the Catholic Church. Believe that alone. But it's not that I don't believe in God. I don't have to go to a building to believe in God.
That's how I am, yeah.
I believe in God because I know what I did learn through Catholic school. But for me personally, I can go and sleep in my bed and say my prayers, my Our Fathers and everything else, and still believe in God.
Yeah.
I believe in heaven. The whole reincarnation part, I just don't know. I don't know. I don't read anything on it, so I don't know what that is.
So... I was at a time where I had, so I would consider myself naive up until the point that my wife was a raging alcoholic, cheated on me multiple times, and all these things happened. We had two small kids, two tiny kids. You know, they were small at the time.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand it. I realized she had some very serious issues from when she was a child that I didn't really understand the full ramifications of, because she'd never really dealt with them and whatever. So I had been what I would call cracked wide open at the time. This was, I don't know what year it was. 2011, I don't know, 2012, no, 2010. Anyway, so I had really done, I was freaking reading everything and, like, you know, listening to all the podcasts were just out at that time, I think it was, or audiobooks, which I don't remember, one of the two I was listening to. Reading and listening to everything I could. So I was really trying to get in with my intuition. And that has been my number one thing since then, is like to try to listen to that quiet, you know, what I would call the soul, like that voice inside of you. Mm. And I would have these conversations with it. This is going to sound nuts, but I was driving down Lakeshore Drive, and I don't remember where I was coming from or going to, but I remember that I had about an hour between these two showings. And it is the strongest sense. There's four or five times in my life where I had intense feelings of like something's taking over my body and like everything about me. I remember driving north down Lakeshore Drive, and I'm like, I got to go to a bookstore. I got to go to this bookstore. And I'm like, what? What if I go to this bookstore? I don't even know where this bookstore is. Yes, you know where this bookstore is. Like, there was this voice inside of me that was like willing me 100% to go to this bookstore.
Yeah.
Strongest spiritual, maybe. It's tied for the two strongest spiritual things that ever happened to me. So I don't know where this bookstore is. So I end up driving to Uptown, which I didn't, nowhere near where my showing was. And I end up going to this bookstore. There's a parking spot literally in front of the front door. To this day, I can't find that bookstore. I live like less than a mile from it.
Yeah.
I can't find it. I don't know where it is. I don't think it like disappeared. I think that, you know, a lot has changed since then in 10 years, 12 years that, you know, it's probably torn down or whatever. But it was a single story bookstore. I parked right in front of it. And at this point, I'm just having a conversation with what, depends who you are. But somebody, some people might call it God, spirit, your angels, whatever you want.
The universe.
Call it what you want, the universe. So I walk in the door, and I literally walked in the front door, and I remember stopping inside the front door. I'm like, okay, you're a pain in my ass right now. Like, where do you want me to go? And it literally led me right to the aisle, right to the book. And the book was called Destiny of Souls by Michael Newton. I think it was Destiny. And then Journey of Souls was his first book. They didn't have the first book. And I remember standing in front of him and going, that's the book you want me to get? And this voice was like, yep. It wasn't even a voice, it was a feeling. It was like, yep. So I just reached for it. I was like, it was crazy. So.
And what was the book about? Obviously, is it reincarnation or what is it?
Reincarnation. So he's a clinical psychologist, and I got home, and it was, by the time, because I was busy and I had stuff going on, by the time I got home, it was like 8 o'clock at night, and sat down in bed, and I was starting to read it, and I'm like, oh man, this is his second book. His first book is, I can't remember which one's which. I think Destiny of Souls is the second. Journey of Souls is first. I was like, oh, I don't have the first book. I'd like to read the first book. And then I'm like, oh, I have an iPad. Maybe I can find it on there. Be-de-de-de. Found it on there. I read till probably 2 or 3 in the morning. I didn't quite finish the book, but I was 100% enthralled with it. And he talks about, so he's a clinical psychologist. I don't remember when this was. It was probably, the, you know, I think he wrote that book in the 90s or maybe late 80s. But anyways, so he didn't really believe, he's not a religious man, he didn't believe in a lot of things. He started discovering that he could pull people back into these past lives, and there was this consistent, they were all seeing the exact same things, people that were totally unrelated. And I was completely fascinated by it. So I ripped through that book, ripped through the next book, and then it just opened the rabbit hole, man. So, and so here I am.
But, yeah, I have a hard time with it, I guess. And I mean, there's a part of me that wants to believe, obviously I believe in heaven, but there's a part of me that wants to believe that I can come back, because I have that fear of that if I'm gone, I'm gone, and that I end.
Yeah. Like, I think a lot of people have that fear.
And I'll say this to you.
If you have the fear of death, I think the best thing you can do, so then I got down the rabbit hole of NDEs, you know, near-death experiences. So everything, you know, one thing connects to the next, then all of a sudden you're, you know, years later doing crazy shit. So if you have a fear of death, the best thing I think you can do is read about verifiable NDEs, near-death experiences. There's a ton of them. Dr. Evan Alexander is one of the best examples out there. Just start looking into it. But not like the people that are on YouTube that are sensationalized. You know, look at some of the really quality books out there. University of Virginia has, I can't remember the name of the department there. I think it's the Department of Perceptual Studies. They have multiple people that have come out of there that have written many books with case studies and things like that. And you can read these case studies of people that have what they call near-death experiences. But these are verifiable cases that, you know, hit a certain amount of criteria that just go there.
You're gonna make me go down this rabbit hole.
I'm not gonna try to explain it, but I mean, at the end of the day, when you put together like the work of Dr. Michael Newton and all these other people that have done it since then, and probably going way back, because this goes way back, especially in the Eastern traditions, like you know, it all connects to weave one tale that is, it's all the same. Like the tale is consistent throughout. We come from a place that's all loving. It's, you know, all knowing. We come here, what they call it, the Earth School, because this is the school that we come to learn. We take a physical body and we learn these lessons of pain and struggle and things, and we become stronger and wiser and, you know, more compassionate and things like that because of it. And when you look at the way that this whole thing's weaved, it's like a big tapestry. Like when you read about NDEs extensively, I can't even tell you how many case studies I've read on NDEs, hundreds probably. Same with past life, you know, progressions, and you know, it all weaves the same tale. Like we come from this all-loving place. You're going to go back to that place. You're going to reincarnate until you learn your lessons, and then I don't know where you go after that.
But you know, reading the book, I mean, that's what you actually portray. Is it's all about loving somebody, just peace, just patience. You've got way more patience when stuck. Because I come, I'll call you. I know, but I've called you on more time.
A couple times.
I am like ready to rip somebody a new one, and I'm like already ballistic, and you're like, Gus, why are you like, just why? Just let it go. Like, dude, you can't control.
Feels good in the moment, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But I mean, you have been able to talk me off the ledge so many times, especially in the longer than the last year, 2, 3, 4 years that, you know, that we've talked about a lot of stuff.
Oh yeah, I remember.
But
well, I had to talk me off the edge first to learn that. So I can help you.
But you've been helping me with that. But you're always, dude, you are like the more Zen, patient person.
Well,
I mean, I'm trying to get to where I'm more patient with a lot of stuff. And I think I've done really well over the last year or so, where I've actually been able to be more patient with a lot of stuff and not let road rage bullshit, like, why this fucking guy cut me off? I'm gonna honk the horn. I'm gonna, like, you know, now it's just like, all right,
whatever.
Hey, if you're in that big of a hurry, go, man, dude, have at it. I'm not gonna be.
Yeah, there's days that you're better at it, days that you're worse, right?
But I'm really actually trying to work at it. But you have been doing it already for so long that, and I read, I heard it in the book that you are like really, like, kind of like just. It's just going to be. Just let it be. Don't, like.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to try to do that, but I can't always cash the check, you know?
Like, I don't think anybody's godly to be able to do that. I mean, I know it's hard for everybody, but the way you, I mean, like I said, I heard you in here. I'm like, because I remember our conversations that we've had. And I'm like, I remember this conversation. It was like almost verbatim what I was reading that you were telling me.
I was probably writing about it at the time because, I don't know. I mean, I consider myself fortunate because I've had so many great teachers before me in the form of a book. I never sat down with anybody. I just, you know, I never connected with anybody religion-wise. I remember different churches and stuff we went to, but that always felt so foreign to me. So for me, it was books and, you know, like audiobooks and things like that. And so those were my teachers. And I think that's what most of us, it's just a chain reaction of everybody's just pushing forward, you know?
Well, what's funny for me too, though, is because as a guy, I never, and it's probably something that a lot of guys don't do is we don't have that person that we can actually confide in. And for me, back years ago, I thought therapy was bullshit. I didn't believe in therapy at all.
Yeah. What do you think now about therapy?
I love it. I mean, it's helped me so much to grow and to learn and gave me tools to be able to change the way my attitude is about certain things.
Yeah.
And how I deal with certain situations. I never would have been able to do that. And I've tried to do it on my own, and it didn't get me. I mean, obviously, I messed some things up. Last relationships.
Well, that's human nature.
Relationships or whatever. But in talking to you, you're probably the only person that I, and my, and Lewis, cousin Lewis that I
yeah,
met,
yeah,
are the only two people that I confide in about everything. And it's the first time that I've ever been I've ever been able to do that, because otherwise I just kept everything inside. And it, well, that, basically, and it messed so many things up for me, because of the fact that, you know, you don't realize that when you internalize everything that you think you're holding everything in, but at some point you are taking it out on somebody else. You may
the
not
whole
see
time,
it,
you're
yeah,
taking it out on somebody
but
else.
You don't see it at the time. I didn't see it at the time. I didn't see it in past relationships. I didn't see it in my last relationship that I had. Obviously, she wasn't perfect. I wasn't perfect, but I take the blame on myself, because I was at that point. Now that I realize it, is that my boxes that I've internalized and compartmentalized for so long were overflowing.
Yeah.
And I was, and at the point, I wasn't able to talk to anybody. I didn't know how to talk to anybody. I didn't want to talk to anybody. So when you feel that isolation of like you're by yourself, and you can be in a room of 1,000 people, and you just feel like you're by yourself, and you want, you're crawling skin wide. You're like want to crawl out of your skin because you don't want to be around anybody.
Yeah.
But yet on the outside, you're like, hey, what's going on? Yeah, everything's great. I didn't feel like I had anybody that I could talk to be like, dude, I just want to, like, I don't want to be here, like, ever, and be done.
Well, first of all, it's hard for guys to do that because we're not conditioned to do that.
Yeah, we're not, conditioned. Unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I grew up, I'm lucky because for a while there, I just had my mom, you know, before she got remarried, and, you know, my dad was, you know, since I was, like, whatever, kindergarten, but... So I'm in touch with the power of the feminine a little more than the average male, because I didn't have a male around for a while. And then when I had a stepdad around, he wasn't, you know, we didn't jive. Now I get along with him great, but when we were young, we just butted heads nonstop. I mean, so for me, I always had a strong feminine, you know, person in my life. And it's so funny because when I was at Michigan State, like I had like the girls, I had this group of girls that I was really good friends with. Mm-hmm. And they called me one of the girls. And I was the only guy that was allowed in the girls' section. And I know what that's from. It's from my mom.
Yeah.
Because I grew up with her and, like, I remember her music. I remember all that stuff, you know. It's like, it was not the stuff dudes were doing.
Right.
But my brothers and I were hanging out with my mom. That's all we had. And so.
And you know what? I was the same way. I mean, I was raised by my mom.
It was
my
great.
Sister and I, just my mom. But it, I think things changed for me. And I don't know why they changed. Cause, I mean, other than the jobs and things like that I had. But even after that, when I got divorced and I was out, I had more girlfriends, yeah, but I didn't confide in them. They confided in me, I guess, because I was able to listen more, but I didn't like try to tell them what to do or anything. But it was, yeah, I had a lot of girlfriends, but literally they were all friends. And like, same thing. Oh, Gus is, he's one of the girls. It was eight girls and it's just
did
me,
you
the only guy.
Did you go to the sleepovers though? I did.
Yeah, so did I.
Nothing ever happened.
No, I did, just, but nothing, just, exactly, nothing friend, happened. But at the same time, I didn't have a guy that I could confide in of like whatever was going on in my life at that time.
Oh, yeah.
See, and
yeah,
I wasn't going to sit here and tell these girls like what's going on in my life, because then I'm a little bitch. I'm not going to, no. You know, they saw me as
well,
a guy
you,
bigger than
when
I
when you say little bitch, you mean like you're showing weakness and stuff.
100%.
But it's, 100%. Yeah, I mean, that's one way to look at it. But it's also when you show that weakness, you expose yourself to people, and then you're connecting on a whole different level with them. And that's what takes a while for us to learn.
But I think, you know, and watching all these videos that I've been watching and all these other things, is that sometimes women, they say they want a good guy and they want a guy to open up to them. I know we're getting kind of off track, but it seems that sometimes those women then will rip you for being honest and giving
well, then
you
that's not
and,
the
and
right
being
woman
honest.
For you. Then
right,
that's
but,
now, just
but
that,
that just but that tears you down and makes you not want to open up, because this woman that you were supposedly in love with or thought that was your person rips you for being honest and being open with them, and then it's like, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah. Yeah, well that sucks, but it's unfortunate that happens, but I'm sure it happens a lot.
Hey, unfortunately.
It's happened to all of us.
Yeah.
But, yeah. It takes a while, I think, for people to build up the strength. For me, it's taken a long time to build up the strength in almost every aspect of my life. So, I mean, I don't think anyone's any different. I mean, some people, you know, seem a lot more confident, and I'm like, oh, great, good for you, it must be nice. But when I was younger, I used to think that. Now I'm like, not really confident, or are you scared? Because that's kind of the way it is. Like,
yeah.
When, now I see it way different. I see things totally different now that I've done, you know, so much work on myself and so much reading and things. And like, Yeah. Interesting world we live in. Well, I mean, we chase, like, all the wrong things.
Yeah. I mean, but just like 100%. Recently, like we've talked about, like, how businesses over the last year or whatever, anytime I have things, you know what? It's going to come. You just got to keep going. And you just, yeah, and that's how you're playing it.
And
that's
where it doesn't, in my mind. Like,
yeah.
I've been through this thing where the Buddhists call it the middle way, right? Like, that's what the Buddha called it. He came, because, you know, he was a prince. And then he tried to do all these different things. And he basically, at one point, he almost killed himself. He tried to starve himself to death. And there was this, I don't know who she was, some lady, like, nursed him back to health on yak milk or something. So, but then the Buddha eventually realized that the middle way is the most sustainable way. So you don't deprive yourself of all things. You don't go in excess of all things, but you find a line up in the middle that, you know, you can live a spiritual, healthy life and still have things. And, you know, and it takes a while to figure that out. You know, it takes a long time to figure that out. And there was the last few years for me, it's like, there was, even now I'm just coming out of it where I didn't care if I made money. I didn't care. I was so immersed in learning about, like, to me, I would call it, like, what spirit is there to teach you, what your soul is really here to teach you. Because at the end of the day, like, like, the biggest game changer, and I already started a second book, and this is what it's about, is, like, when you realize that you're not here for anything else other than your soul to expand and learn and grow and experience, it's a fucking game changer. Because it's like, you're not here to have a big house. You're not here to drive a Ferrari. You're not here to grow a big business. Those things can happen, and sometimes they're a byproduct of things, and sometimes, you know, that's your path because you have certain lessons to learn. But you're here to grow this thing inside of you, yourself, your spirit, the timeless part of you, you know? And when you figure that out, oh, man. It's like, I struggled with money. Like, I didn't even care about it for the last couple years. Like, I've been stressed because I have bills and things like that.
Right.
But I had to go through that. I think I'm coming to a place now where I'm coming, you know, what the Buddhists would say, in the middle. But anyway, so, but a lot of us deal with that. Like, you know, when you have these struggles in your life and you're trying to figure out, like, who you are and what you really want, not what you think you want or not what, you know, your ego tells you want or what society tells you want.
That's the big thing, is the ego.
The ego, yeah, it's...
Because for me, I can only speak for myself. It's the ego of,
yeah,
you know, you want everything. You want things to be great and perfect, but they're not. And then it's like when you don't get to a certain point of where you think you should be, especially in our life at being in the 50s, you would think you would be further along. You would have X, Y, yeah, and Z. And when you're not there, or when you thought things were going to happen in a certain way, because that's the way in your mind, this is the way it's supposed to happen because I'm trying to make it happen, and it doesn't, then you,
yeah,
revert back to, I'm a failure. I failed.
Yeah, that's how we've been taught. How everyone's taught.
And then other people think.
No one teaches you that, but that's how everyone's taught.
Right.
Society tells you that at every turn, at every newscast, at every, you know, car you drive by, that's the Maserati, whatever, where these things are reinforced. Why don't I have that? What's going on with here? Why are they better looking? Look at that skin. Oh, my God. Look at that amazing skin. Look at how tall they are. What the fuck? You know, all these things that we can chase after, but of course, you can't help but tell you. But it's funny because, like, I'm only 5'6", and everybody in my life is like, oh, you have a problem with your shortness. I'm like, no, I never even noticed it. I don't care. I'm who I am. What am I going to do? So, but we chase the wrong things, and that's just the way it's been. And, you know, the Western world's so guilty of it, and the East does a much better job of keeping things in check, I think. But whatever. We're all blending right now anyways. We're in the middle of a mass merger, so.
Yeah. A lot of things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things are changing. So, anything else you want to bring up with your book? I mean, we got into some good stuff, though.
No, I just, you know, I hope people want to read it. It's coming out soon on Amazon, and then eventually be available in the bookstores, hopefully. And
hopefully after April 1st.
Well, let's not say April 1st, but let's just say spring of 2025.
Spring, we're in spring. We just had spring
Thursday. Okay, mid-spring 2025. It's on its way.
All right. Well, perfect. So, perfect. Well, I appreciate you coming in.
All right, man.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And,
cheers. Thanks for the good old fashioned.
Absolutely.
All right. Cheers, man.
And For anybody and everybody, I do suggest you go get it, The Gameful Chaos. It will be available on Amazon, hopefully in middle of spring.
That's coming.
That you will be able to,
May 1st.
May 1st, you will be able to buy the book. I highly suggest you get it. Great book, great read. It's quick. It's about 100 and something pages.
150-ish, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great, great read. Appreciate everybody watching. And again, all facts, no fluff. Appreciate you guys.